This is The Point on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. It is Friday, June 7th. This is our local news roundup. We'll be discussing the week's top stories with reporters and editors from around the region. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Eve Zukoff. We'll speak with Unki Sanu of the Martha's Vineyard Times and Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll hear from Paul Benson at the Provincetown Independent and Jason Graziadei of Nantucket Current. And CAI's Patrick Flannery will speak with our State House reporter Katie Lannan. Now to some of the news around the Cape, the coast, and the islands. Governor Healey came to Martha's Vineyard yesterday. She checked out the new maintenance and operations facilities for the offshore wind company Vineyard Wind. Our own Jeanette Barnes accompanied her and joins us now. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, Steve.
So give us a quick overview of what Healey saw on the tour. These are offshore wind facilities that many people have never seen before.
That's right. Yeah, so first she went to the dock down there on Beach Road, where there are two crew vessels serving Vineyard Wind. And she took a tour of the larger one. It's almost like a small private ferry. It has some very nice reclining seats for the technicians and the other people headed out to the wind farm. And then it has a small galley, some cabins for the crew, and of course, the wheelhouse where the captain has all of his instrumentation. The captain led the tour. He is from Sandwich, Josh Rand. And the governor asked him how old he is because he looked pretty young. And he said he's 28. He's a Mass Maritime graduate. so that was nice to see a local captain. And then after the boat tour, the governor went just a bit down the street there in Vineyard Haven over to the Vineyard Wind Operations and Maintenance Building. It's elevated about 15 feet above street level there to guard against future flooding. But right now it's really just kind of an open warehouse space with offices to the side. Very clean. The warehouse is very, very clean right now. It's brand new and it hasn't been used for parts storage, but that's its destiny there to be kind of a staging point for a lot of the smaller components that a technician would be able to handle themselves. So they're not going to be storing, you know, blades, turbine blades there, but things like gearboxes, actual nuts and bolts, instrumentation, things like that.
Who else was there to meet the governor? I know there was a speaking program at the Vineyard Wind building there.
Yes. So too many to name them all, but there were some local officials there from the town of Tisbury. Senator Sear was there, and a Vineyard Wind technician who is from the Vineyard and just graduated from high school about 6 years ago. He spoke. That was really interesting. In addition to that, the two CEOs of the parent companies of Vineyard Wind were there, which is not too surprising because both of their companies actually are competing right now for new contracts in the latest wind bidding. And their contracts are before the state. I mean, their bids are before the state.
Well, the state is in the middle of evaluating this fresh round of bids for offshore wind. You asked Healey about that. What did she have to say?
She said she is limited in what she can say, precisely because they are in the middle of this public procurement process. But the state, she said, is going big with its request for 3,600 megawatts. And Healey said that shows how much the administration really wants the industry to grow. Incidentally, the date for the winners of that bidding is coming up pretty soon. It's August 7th.
Let's talk a little bit about housing. This week, the state legislature took up a housing bond bill. It's a big package, but it doesn't include something that a lot of housing advocates, particularly in our region, have been calling for, and that's the real estate transfer fee.
That's right. So the House up on Beacon Hill passed its version of the housing bond bill and left this out. This is a fee or a tax, depending on the language you want to use. Opponents usually do call it a tax, but it's on high value real estate, and the money would be used for housing related initiatives by local communities. Excuse me. And one of the most important things to know about it, though, is that it's a local option. So if your town meeting or your town council does not vote to have this in your town, you would not have it. There are a few different formulas out there for how it would work, but Governor Healey's proposal is to place this fee or tax of between 0.5% and 2% on the portion of a home sale price that is either above $1 million or above the county median single family home price, whichever is greater. And that means also that if your home sells for 1.1 million, you only pay it on the 0.1.
This whole process is a good reminder of how legislation gets shaped. As you mentioned, this is the House of Representatives version of the bill, but there may be a moment for the transfer fee to be reinserted into this bill as it moves along. Is that right?
So supporters are hoping that the state Senate will put it in their bill and that it will then make it into the final conferenced version that goes to Healey's desk because she does support this provision. But the chances of that happening, of it, making it all the way through, are pretty unclear at this point. I asked Healey yesterday what she might do to help make sure it gets into the Senate bill, and she said right now that is up to the Senate. Let's see what else. I asked also, though, if she would support an amendment to make this real estate transfer fee available only for the Cape and Islands, because that has been proposed or discussed at least. And she didn't want to comment on that. She said she's not going to comment on something like that unless she sees it, until she sees it.
I know that you spoke to both housing advocates and to folks who are not in support of the transfer fee. Tell us a little bit about what you heard and their takes on this.
Yes, Tucker Holland, who is the former housing director for Nantucket, really is a big backer of this. And essentially, supporters are saying this is a very small fee. Almost, they characterize it almost like a rounding error for people who are buying and selling at these big prices. And they say, this is necessary to support work in the communities that helps other people afford housing to live in our very expensive housing markets here on the Cape and Islands. And then on the other side, one of the big interests is the real estate industry. Supporters of this provision tell me that there are many real estate agents local to the Cape and Islands who support it because of the market conditions here, but the Massachusetts Association of Realtors does not support it. And there's a real estate group in Boston as well that has opposed it. One thing the realtors say is that this fee would increase the overall cost of buying a house, which can cause people to delay housing transactions. And another thing they argued was that it would hurt diversity, which initially surprised me because that's almost like the opposite of the intent in a way. But so I asked them to explain what they meant by that. And they said that because this increases the cost of a home, it makes it harder for new people to buy into areas that are already expensive. That was what they said.
So it may hurt diversity in areas that are very expensive for new people to come into. Okay.
Right. Yes. In the sense that, yes, the people who don't live there now, maybe trying to buy into a community might not be able to because of this additional expense.
And again, this is a fee that would go, or a tax that would go on anything over a threshold. So if that threshold is $1 million, you're only paying the fee or tax on the amount that's above that high
Right.
threshold. Yes.
Yes. Yes.
Let's stay with housing. Earlier in the week, the state's housing secretary came to the Cape and Martha's Vineyard looking to hear from residents about the state's 5-year housing plan. They're just putting this together. Tell us about this forum.
Yes, so I went to the one at Cape Cod Community College. There was one on the Vineyard as well. There were housing advocates there from around the region, a few business owners, and a few local residents who went for their own reasons. It was hosted by the state housing secretary, Ed Augustus. He spoke briefly, but really the main event here was the breakout groups with senior members of his staff who were going to take this information back. So the small groups met in different rooms there at the college, and they talked about things that are working and not working in state housing policy. They were writing down some of their ideas on notes and kind of pasting them up on the wall to answer the different questions that were being asked. And essentially, the state housing staff, they're going to be taking this back and considering all of these ideas for the 5-year housing plan that the Healey administration is working on.
What kinds of things did people bring up, and what was the sense of how these might fit into the state's effort to address the housing crisis?
In the room where I was, rental vouchers came up quite a bit. People said the voucher system is working, but it needs more funding and a much shorter wait time. Someone said there's a 3 to 5 year wait right now for a voucher. Some of the other issues people talked about had to do with helping year-rounders and dealing with the issue of short-term rentals. One issue that people brought up was they wanted year-round deed restrictions on homes to be an option for people to do that. Someone else said that accessory dwelling units, which are becoming pretty popular, should be barred from use as short-term rentals.
It's the AI's Jeanette Barnes. Jeanette, it has been a busy week for you. I know you covered even more than we can get to today, and you're about to head out and connect with Senator Markey, who's coming on to the Cape to, in part, to talk about the bridges, the progress on the project to replace the Cape's bridges, the Bourne and Sagamore bridges.
That's right. Yes. I will be reporting back.
Okay, we will check in with you. That is the AI's Jeanette Barnes. Jeanette, thanks.
Okay. Thanks, Steve.
This is the news roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll speak with CAI's Eve Zukoff. Stay with us. This is the news roundup on The Point. We are talking about the top local stories of the week with reporters and editors from around the region. I'm Steve Junker. After 4 years waiting for results, Hyannis residents have learned how the levels of PFAS chemicals in their blood compare to the rest of the country, and the results are strikingly high. CAI reporter Eve Zukoff has this story and joins us now. Hi, Eve.
Hi, Steve.
Let's start with the larger study here. Set the scene for us. What was this about?
Sure. So this study is called the Massachusetts PFAS and Your Health Study. It's one of 7 projects that was launched in 2020, funded by the CDC, and the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry. So it's part of a national effort to investigate communities across the country, including Hyannis, that have been affected by PFAS contaminants in drinking water. Hyannis in 2016 was found to have the highest levels of PFAS in drinking water in the state of Massachusetts. And this is all really important because the chemicals, PFAS, have been linked to change just so many health issues, changes in thyroid levels, cancer, fertility issues, increased cholesterol, immunodeficiency, decrease in birth weights, developmental effects. I mean, the list goes on.
So, cut to the chase. What did the scientists find here?
Yeah, well, just to say here, there are 14,000 known kinds of PFAS chemicals, all with different names, things like PFOA, PFOS, etc. Silent Spring only looked at a handful, because you can't test for them all, really. And they found that among residents who lived in Hyannis over a recent 10-year period, blood levels of one type, for example, PFHXS, were about 3 times higher than the median for the general population. And there were outliers. Like for PFHXS, one woman in Hyannis told me her levels were 15 times the national average. Overall, when they measured the 7 types of PFAS that they were looking for and they added up all those numbers in blood, the researchers found that Hyannis has a higher proportion of adults with blood levels over 20 parts per billion. That's kind of how we measure PFAS. That's the unit, than the general population. So about 38% of Hyannis residents have this extremely high level of PFAS in their blood compared to just 13% of the average population, nearly 3 times. And that is putting people in the highest risk category for PFAS-related health effects. You know, that means people should be getting more screenings from their doctors and really aware of their risk levels.
Why? Remind us why levels are so high in Hyannis.
Yeah, in Hyannis, the problem is really that for decades, this PFAS Latin firefighting foam that was used at Barnstable County Fire Training Academy and Barnstable Municipal Airport, now the Gateway Airport, was just kind of sprayed willy-nilly. This is kind of before the concept of chemical management was really a thing. And because of the Cape's sandy, porous soil, it just traveled with ease through the groundwater into the aquifer that provides the region with its drinking water.
Any other patterns in this study that you wanted to call out here for us?
Yeah, well, they compared the results between hyannis men and women and adults and children. They found that PFAS levels were slightly higher in men than women. This is in line with findings that menstruating women shed blood more frequently and therefore have lower PFAS levels. Kind of, that was bizarre to me. Across the oldest adults, age 65 and up, their blood levels of PFAS were 2 to 3 times higher than the youngest adults, age 18 to 44. That also makes sense because PFAS bioaccumulates in our bodies. And then maybe a little bit of good news here, but I don't know. They compared children ages 4 to 17 to those adults who took part in the study, and they saw that adults had 3 to 4 times higher levels of PFAS in their blood than children.
So we know that in Hyannis, this firefighting foams that were used there got into the water supply. Now that the water supply is safe, the Hyannis Water Department is filtering these out.
Yes.
But these were there for a while and at very high levels. But drinking water isn't the only place that people get exposed to these chemicals.
No, PFAS chemicals are incredible when you think about it from an engineering point of view for their ability to be oil resistant, water resistant, stain resistant. So they're in so many of the things we touch every day: carpet, upholstery, waterproof apparel, greaseproof food packaging, cosmetics, paints. But they were invented kind of in the 1940s and 50s to be really useful for things like surgical tools and syringes and catheters that need to be resistant to degradation. But, you know, here we are. They're now in all of these things that they perhaps don't need to be in. And the health consequences are what we all now have to deal with.
So people who participated in this study got a clear sense of what their PFAS levels are, and many of them finding out that they're quite elevated. Is there anything people can do to lower their blood levels of PFAS contamination?
It's tricky because, again, PFAS chemicals resist degradation. So the best kind of advice from experts is to avoid anything that says it has PFAS in it. Like, don't get that cookware, you know, nonstick cookware that says, like, PFOS free, for example. That means they probably put many other kinds of PFAS in it. They say, you know, eating fresh foods is really good. But for some people who found their blood levels in this study, obviously that is not enough.
You talked to two women who had extremely high levels of PFAS in their blood, and they just tell us, are they seeing the effects of PFAS exposure? Do you know?
Yeah, it seems like it. I mean, they are the first to say, look, we can't, and this is part of the insidiousness of this, they can't directly link the health issues they've seen with PFAS. I mean, that's part of why these manufacturers get away with this. But they have seen unusual and clearly linked health issues like high cholesterol, thyroid disease, a surprise pancreatitis case for this one woman named Jane Walsh. And it's really... it's really scary to them. You know, someone like Jane is a person who is a single mom, and she told me, I can't let anything happen to me. And they are starting to see these effects and forming community around that.
And what else are they doing to deal with the results? Are they what kind of options are there for them?
Yeah, there are more kind of aggressive options for those who have these really high blood level results. Two of them in particular, there is this cholesterol medication that appears to, you know, help people kind of lower their PFAS blood levels. There needs to be more study there. There was also a study done based on Australian firefighters who were doing regular every 12 weeks getting their blood donated, and that appeared to pretty significantly lower their PFAS blood levels. So this woman, Jane Walsh, she told me, I am now every 12 weeks going to give my blood, you know, and that is the level that people are getting to. She said, it's just part of my routine, like medical practices now. Because as a single mom, you know, this is how she has to deal.
That is CAI's Eve Zukoff. Eve, thank you.
Thank you.
I know you're going to be coming back toward the end of the show. I don't want to give away too much about that.
But okay.
We'll be checking back in with you.
Tease. I like it.
The District Attorney's Office and the Office of Dukes County Sheriff Bob Ogden are engaged in a legal dispute that may jeopardize the prosecution of a number of cases on Martha's Vineyard. Unki Sanu of the Martha's Vineyard Times has this story and joins us. Hi, Unki.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me.
This has to do with something called Brady materials. Essentially, when the DA is prosecuting a case, it's bound by law to disclose any time a police officer involved may have a record of lying under oath, using excessive force, demonstrating racial bias, or other illegal behavior. The previous attorney general here, or the previous district attorney, I should say, had not been gathering this information. Is that right?
From what we've been told, the current district attorney, Robert Galloway, says that, or at least his office says that, there was a lack of a Brady disclosure policy in place before this administration came into that office. So they're trying to gather around 20 years worth of these disclosures. And currently, at least in Edgartown District Court's side of things, they are trying to get the disclosures for around 12 cases, although two have been thrown out by now.
Okay, so explain the sheriff there is I guess the district attorney would say that the sheriff is not cooperating with this. Is that right?
That's how it could be put. Yeah. Essentially, we've tried to reach the sheriff's office. Haven't really gotten a lot of answers back, but we did get a letter, and Sheriff Ogden claims that these disclosures would have would be a burden to his office with the amount of material that would be needed, and alongside a worry that this whatever information goes out could have a negative impact on staff, especially because this is a small community and whatnot. The district attorney, Robert Galloway, has essentially dismissed these claims because saying what they're looking for are records of, sheriff's employees who have engaged in the types of things that you mentioned earlier, such as excessive force, lying, or sexual harassment, et cetera.
So there are a number of cases right now that are before the court that are sort of hanging up on the sheriff producing these materials, the Brady materials, around the officers that were involved in the case, and the cases can't move forward. Is that how this is right now?
At the moment, yeah, they're at a bit of a standstill source. The DA's office is trying to maybe filing more motions as time goes on. But apparently the Deuce County Sheriff's Office isn't the only place that's resisting these requests. There's also some pushback from the Barstool sheriff's side of things. So there may be more details to come as time progresses.
The Dukes County Sheriff there, one of the things he points to is the fact that he's concerned that any type of allegations which might have been made from members of the community against a police officer, whether they're founded or unfounded, might come out in this Brady materials gathering, and that wouldn't be fair to officers. But the district attorney here is kind of pushing back on that assertion.
Right. Sheriff Bob Ogden, he's essentially saying, some of these materials he might be more used by folks who have a bit of an agenda against law enforcement. But and the attorney's office, they're not really buying that source. They're saying they told what type of records they want. The sheriff has expressed his concerns regarding potential impact to retaining staff and whatnot, especially because I'm a small community. And the sheriff and the district attorney's office says we don't want things that are unfounded. We want the records of when the officers have done wrong things.
Mm. Is there any sense of where this goes from here? What kind of timeline they're looking at to try to resolve this or these cases?
The timeline seems a little bit murky at the moment, but right now there are 10 cases that are on the line here at Edgartown District Court, and we don't exactly know when it'll all occur. They could be dismissed. They might not be. We'll have to kind of see what other movements occur in the court system and the sheriff's office and whatnot.
Mm. It's a complicated story. You can read all about it in the Martha's Vineyard Times. Unki Sanu, thank you.
Thank you.
Chatham is looking at removing 250 or more trees from protected areas around wetlands near the town's airport. Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle joins us to explain what this is about. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Steve.
Tim, as we've talked about in the past, there's a lot of tension in town around the airport. What's being proposed here is intended to help with planes using the airport. Is that right?
Yeah, it's part of the Airport Commission's updated master plan. For years, the town has neglected to trim trees around the airport. You know, obviously, there are height limitations on trees that are within the airport's flight zones. You know, you don't want trees growing up into areas where planes are flying. It's a safety issue, and that's what the Airport Commission keeps insisting. While opponents of or critics of the airport say that the town is the Airport Commission is overreaching on these things, that they're going to be cutting down more trees than are necessary. The most recent development here involves the Conservation Commission, which has jurisdiction over about 2.6 acres of land in and around the airport that either are wetlands or abut wetlands. And last week they heard from the Airport Commission's consultant about specific numbers on how many trees will have to be taken down around those areas in order to prevent them from growing up into the flight areas. And right now that number is about 250, as you said, Steve. The consultant said it could be as many as 300 trees. They won't know until they get in there to actually do the work because it's very dense and thick around. There's a vernal pool and there's a couple of ponds near the airport where the Conservation Commission has jurisdiction. Now, this doesn't include probably 50 plus acres of land around the airport, much of it private land, where trees are going to have to be either trimmed or removed because they either threaten to or have already grown up in the flight path.
I know the airport is kind of trying to look at this holistically, saying that they're going to plant trees elsewhere to sort of keep a balance in what's happening here. And then also when these trees get removed, what happens then to this piece of land? Does it just get overgrown with other kinds of species?
Well, the plan is to try to go into these areas and not only take out any trees that are problematic, but also to try to remove as many of the invasive species that have grown up in these conservation areas and replace those with native species, which are low growing and hopefully won't be a problem in the future. The Airport Commission's plan calls for more closely monitoring these areas. So the plan is a long-term plan. It goes off, it goes at least 5 years into the future for not only continually removing any problematic vegetation, but also monitoring it. And the town recently passed a tree protection bylaw, part of which establishes a fund which will hold money to plant trees around town. If someone has to take down a tree for safety reasons or something else, they can contribute to this fund. So the Airport Commission is proposing to contribute at least $7,500 per acre of land that they have to come in and cut to that fund so that trees could be planted in other areas of town to replace the ones that are being lost.
Mm. Tim, real quick, last week we talked about a very close select board race. It was decided by, I think, three votes. It turns out there's going to be a recount, which is probably no surprise.
Sure. This was in Brewster, where challenger Laurel Labden fell three votes shy of Amanda Bebrin for a seat on the board on the select board. And Labden has petitioned for recounts in all three precincts in Brewster. That recount is going to happen on Tuesday. And last year, Labden lost out on a seat in the board to by 5 votes after a recount. So she decided that she wanted to make sure every vote counted, and that's why she was pushing for this recount. This is going to happen Tuesday, and we'll be watching it, and we'll have the results as soon as they're available.
Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
You're listening to the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. We are going to the break now. When we come back, we'll hear from Paul Benson of the Provincetown Independent. Stay with us. This is the local news roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We are talking about the top local stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. FBI agents were in Provincetown this week. They were training town residents on how to be prepared for the unthinkable. Paul Benson of the Provincetown Independent is here to explain what's happening. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Steve.
This has to do with June being Pride Month, and the agents were providing training in reaction to potential threats of violence. Tell us about this.
Well, there was a May 10th warning from the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security that said Pride events worldwide and in America were at a heightened risk. There had been 3 reasons they believed that. ISIS had been using English language recruiting materials that focused on homophobia as a recruiting tactic, which was kind of a new avenue of trying to find people for them. There was a plot foiled in Vienna last summer that was going to be an attack on a Pride parade. And then the anniversary of the Pulse nightclub shooting is every June 12th, and that always presents a little bit of a heightened risk, evidently.
So the FBI, explain a little bit how this came about, because this is interesting, too. How did the FBI end up doing this training session in Provincetown?
Well, it's not a thought that hasn't crossed people's minds. You know, we have really big crowds at some of these venues, and when bad things happen in the news, and you look around the next day at work or at a social gathering, wherever you might be, you're like, oh, gosh. Hmm. So it's not an unheard of conversation around here. The assistant town manager had those questions brought to him before. So when this alert went out, he had friends in the FBI that he contacted and said, hey, is there any chance you can do the walkthroughs for local businesses here that I've heard you're doing in New York City?
This was held at Town Hall, and the focus of this was on kind of this paradigm they call run, hide, fight. Explain a little bit what the FBI agent told the group that gathered. It was a big group that came out.
There were 160 people, which is a lot for a Monday evening in June. There were a lot of bar and restaurant owners and managers and staff. There were also more retired people than I expected, and a lot of working people who just wanted to know what they could do to keep these venues safer.
I'm curious to hear a little bit more about like what were some of the strategies that the FBI agent was attempting to communicate to folks to help everybody feel a little bit safer, a little bit more prepared for something happening.
It was Agent Anthony Greco, and he was sort of articulating that the lockdown model, what he called the nuclear drill under your desk, stay silent and wait, is sort of not current doctrine. There have been some really bad episodes where the shooter wound up inside the room that people were locked down, whether he forced his way in or was already inside. And then he said that becomes a worst case scenario. People aren't moving. They haven't made a plan. They're all separated from each other. And he picks people off one by one, basically. So this paradigm focuses more on active response, going for exits, taking any opportunity to escape, windows, fences, all kinds of things. And should you find yourself stuck, yes, hide is one modality. You might barricade a door with thick objects and turn off your phones. But if you're stuck in a place that isn't barricadable, then sort of look at the people around you and see what kind of improvised weapons, and 3 or 4 people make a decision to like go for the arms and go for the head, basically. Mm. And that modality, especially focusing on the running part, I think they felt that the lockdown strategy, people were missing chances to get out of the property or get out of the venue or get out of the building, and they didn't want that to keep happening.
Can I ask you about the wider conversation around this? This is such a hard thing to look at as, in preparing for something that you'd never want to see happen. Were there people who felt like it's going too far to try to you know, to bring this front and center and talk about something like this? Or was there a sense that this was really needed in the community, or kind of both, I guess?
Kind of both. We had a pretty vigorous discussion about it in the newsroom. You know, the trainings that they do in schools have such a sort of a deserved poor reputation that becomes the paradigm that people go to, like, why are we even doing this? But the truth is, people who have worked in these venues for years are frequently, have already been thinking about it, are not going to be freshly traumatized by the experience of thinking about it, and would kind of like some kind of suggestion of what to do. And I said it's sort of like earthquake training, you know, the overwhelming likelihood is it'll never happen. And then if it happens, kind of the overwhelming likelihood is it's all completely out of your control. Mm-hmm. But there are moments where, like, okay, get in a doorway or get in a bathtub, and just having some idea of, well, a door in an earthquake, I'm saying, a doorway is safer than some other part of the house. Okay, at least you have something for your mind to grab onto. Mm-hmm. And this did provide, you know, okay, here's something for your mind to grab onto. Try to do X, even if X is impossible or even if X is too late. At least you have some semblance of a goal of what you should be trying to do, which they said too many people were locking down and not enough people were running, in short.
Paul Benson of the Provincetown Independent, where you can read all about it. Paul, thank you.
Of course. A pleasure.
Fast ferry service from Nantucket on the Steamship Authority was canceled last Sunday, not for mechanical issues, but because of staffing shortages. It's part of a bigger picture of what the ferry line is dealing with right now and how it could impact the summer for islanders. Jason Grazide of Nantucket Current has details and joins us. Hi, Jason.
Good morning.
What happened Sunday that canceled all the fast ferry trips?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, you know, you look outside, it's a beautiful day, no mechanical issues, but the INO, which is the fast ferry that runs between Hyannis and Nantucket by the Steamship Authority, was canceled all day. So this was a really unusual thing to have happen. What we learned was that they had a pilot, one of the licensed deck officers who operates the boat, called out sick, and the Steamship Authority had no other qualified personnel available to fill in for the day, and so all four of those round trips between Hyannis and Nantucket were canceled. You know, that had a knock-on effect for a lot of people on the island. Sports games were canceled, people scrambling to switch over to the High Line or get on one of the car ferries. Now, the steamship did, you know, promise a full refund to all those people, but what we reported this week is sort of trying to drill down on what happened here. You know, the licensed deck officer shortage that the steamship is experiencing, we've talked about that over the last year a lot, and that is not new. You know, they're dealing with everything from retirements, long-term illnesses, you know, really challenges in recruiting, and, you know, the complexity and the time necessary for licensing new officers. All that stuff has been playing out over the past year. What we heard from numerous people at the Steamship Authority, that this was actually something that is at the root of it, is being caused by the negotiations of a new collective bargaining agreement for the licensed deck officers, who have basically informally decided that they are not going to sort of work and fill in and take shifts above and beyond one, like, you know, their normal schedule. And one of the people at the Steamship Authority termed it a quote unquote overtime strike, where these shifts that previously someone would have came in and filled in, the licensed deck officers, as a way to sort of gain leverage in those collective bargaining agreements, are basically saying, we're not going to do that anymore until we get what we're asking for at the bargaining table.
Which they say is a better rate of pay and better working conditions.
Yeah, it's a combination of things. What we've been hearing really from the Teamsters, which represents the Steamship Authority's licensed deck officers, is that, yes, it's a combination of, you know, better pay, but really scheduling and quality of life for the licensed deck officers. There's about 50 or 60 that are represented by the Teamsters in New Bedford, and they're talking about, you know, the schedule, having to work 18 hours within a 24-hour period. They do then get 48 hours off, but that is really something that is difficult for the existing staff. It's hurting the steamship's ability to recruit new licensed deck officers. It was an exemption that was provided by the Coast Guard years ago that allows the steamship to have that type of schedule. But they are really calling it out now, and we've seen the sort of knock-on effects both in the shortage and then also the way this is playing out in collective bargaining.
And what does the Steamship Authority say when you reached out to them on this?
Yeah, so, you know, we did reach out, and, you know, they have seen, you know, what is happening. You know, they did, you know, some of the Board of Governors had some quotes about, you know, the challenges of hiring licensed deck officers, things that they're doing to recruit. But, you know, the communications director, Sean Driscoll, said, you know, they're saying they're in active negotiations, so they don't really want to go too much into it, but that they're, you know, looking forward to reaching a fair and equitable agreement for both parties, for the steamship, for the licensed deck officers. But they're not going to get into the sort of particulars of the union negotiations in public right now.
Mm. Jason Grazide of the Nantucket Current. Jason, that's all we have time for, but I want to send folks to your website because you have a great photo essay of the Main Street Fountain being put back into place finally. It's a photo saga there, and folks can check it out there at the website of the Nantucket Current. Jason, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me on.
Immigration policy at the national level is shifting, with new limits on border crossings going into effect under President Biden. Closer to home, Governor Healey has weighed in on how it affects the state's shelter system. And there was also a late-night move on affordable housing at the State House. Our Morning Edition host Patrick Flannery spoke with our correspondent at the State House, Katie Lannon, about the week's news from Beacon Hill. Here's their conversation.
Katie, the biggest story of the week is immigration, the president's shift toward shutting out certain asylum seekers. And this was a move that Governor Healey supports. She had been a major force in securing all that money for the state's shelter system, but it's overwhelmed now. So, Katie, what do you make of the governor's move? Is this an about-face with the election just 5 months out?
One thing about the migrant crisis here in Massachusetts is it's first and foremost a humanitarian issue. It's created logistical and financial challenges for state government, but it's also put Governor Healey in a really interesting political position because she wants to see more done from Washington, D.C. to help the state ease the influx of new arrivals here, but she's also a close political ally of President Biden. She is in a advisory board for his reelection campaign, and she has mostly targeted her criticisms at Republicans in Congress. She's been pretty positive about President Biden's actions so far, so I don't think this is a shift for her necessarily, and we did hear her as well continuing to call for Congress to do more. So I think it's in line with what we've been hearing from her so far, and she herself has taken some steps that have been unpopular with some immigration advocates when it comes to limiting shelter stays or setting guidelines here for who can access those services.
A local option real estate fee supported by many on the Cape and Islands has been left out of the House version of a state bill. Nantucket in particular, Katie, has called for what's known as a transfer fee to help pay for affordable housing. Theoretically, it would apply to home sales in excess of $1 million. There was some movement on this late at night on Thursday, right?
Yeah, the House passed their $6.5 billion version of this bill, and they did it without anyone trying to add the transfer fee language back in, at least not trying in earnest. There had been amendments proposed to add that language back in or different versions of it, and no one forced a vote on those, which does signal that there just wasn't support broadly in the House, enough votes to get it through. And one thing that is interesting, you mentioned Nantucket. We did hear the House Speaker, when explaining his position, his thinking on this proposal, he said that it's something that would raise a lot of money in Nantucket, where houses are so expensive, but it wouldn't do anything in somewhere like Lawrence. So he calls it inequitable and kind of a scattered policy that would only help communities that have money already. Of course, the communities where housing prices are out of control are the ones that want to opt into this. But House Democrats weren't on board with what they described as a piecemeal approach to housing policy. The question now comes if senators will be interested in pursuing the transfer tax. It's something that seems to have more support in that branch, so we could see it reemerge when they tackle the bill.
Finally, Katie, it's been a couple of years almost since the Supreme Court overturned Roe versus Wade. And this week, Governor Healey called on Congress to protect the right to access birth control. Of course, after that, a bill known as the Right to Contraception Act was blocked. What happens now at this point in the year?
The big thing we're going to see happen is this is going to be a campaign issue for Democrats. I think there was not a lot of expectation that Republicans would go along with this bill. But thing that Healey and Democrats in Washington, including Ed Markey, the lead sponsor of this bill, want to do is put them on record, either voting against the bill or, as we saw in the Senate, voting to block consideration of it. So that's something they can point to in election season, that Republicans, according to the Democrats, don't support the right to contraception. Republicans say they have their other issues with the bill. They say it's not necessary. But we're going to see this as an issue in the U.S. House as well. Another Massachusetts lawmaker, Catherine Clark, is trying to force a vote there. So expect this to be a drumbeat that continues as we inch closer to November.
And we are getting closer every day. Katie Lannon from the State House, as always, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
That is our State House correspondent, Katie Lannon, speaking with our own CAI's Patrick Flannery. You're listening to the News Roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. To finish off this week, we have a couple of unusual animal stories, and because we can't get enough of her, CAI's Eve Zukoff returns with these. Hi, Eve.
Hi, Steve.
A flamingo was seen Sunday afternoon wading through the shallows off Chapin Beach in Dennis. Yes, a flamingo, one of those Florida birds. Tell us about this bird and how it might have gotten to Cape Cod.
Sure. So photos of this flamingo started making the rounds on Facebook, and CAI's very own Bird Report author Mark Faraday jumped on this. He confirmed their veracity. And he says, yeah, normally we would assume a flamingo in Massachusetts would have escaped from a zoo or a private collection. Like, this is nowhere near their range. And that actually was the case back in 1964 with two flamingos that turned up north of Boston. And there was a Chilean flamingo that spent time along Monomoy in 1985. But he believes this one is here because back in August, a hurricane that ripped through the Gulf of Mexico picked up a number of flamingos along the Yucatan Peninsula and then just kind of dropped them around the eastern U.S. So since then, flocks of flamingos have been seen in Florida, Georgia, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania.
So there's a historical context here for flamingos. This sighting is coming the same week as the sighting of an orca off Chatham, another highly unusual animal for this region.
Yes, the Cape Cod Times reported that a group of Cape Codders were fishing on Sunday when this orca came close to their boat. Researchers from the New England Aquarium confirmed this is a whale called Old Tom, who's been seen many times or several times off Cape Cod in the last decade, usually around this time, late spring, early summer. And yeah, it is really strange to see an orca in local parts, but Old Tom isn't any old orca. His range basically is Cape Cod Bay into the Gulf of Maine, Bay of Fundy, and he's here saying hi.
So Old Tom wasn't the only whale seen in an unexpected place. Talk to us a little bit about what's going on with right whales and sei whales at this moment.
Yes. So on recent aerial survey flights, also researchers from the New England Aquarium saw 25 endangered sei whales and two groups of right whales. Both were spending time in or near busy shipping lanes just south of Martha's Vineyard and Nantucket. The problem is that these sightings are coming a month after officials lifted local protections that, you know, because it's largely been thought that right whales migrate north in the summertime. No need for, you know, fishing limits and speed limits and stuff like that. So researchers are warning that boat collisions and entanglements, they still are the leading causes of death for North Atlantic right whales. And that these recent sightings should maybe be a reminder that not all right whales head north. Many or some number maybe are here year-round, and more speed limits may be needed to keep them safe.
That is CAI's Eve Zukoff with the Animal Roundup. Who knows what we'll be talking about next week?
Let's do like hamsters, like small fowl next week, something like that.
Thank you, Eve.
Thank you.
That's the news for today. I want to thank all my guests. We heard from CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Eve Zukoff. We spoke with Unki Sanu of the Martha's Vineyard Times and Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. We heard from Paul Benson of the Provincetown Independent and Jason Grazide of Nantucket Current. And CAI's Morning Edition host Patrick Flannery checked in with our State House reporter Katie Lannon. Big thanks to Dan Treidel for engineering the program. He's got the helm on the flight deck, and you know that means we are in good hands. Thanks, Dan. Thank you for listening. In Woods Hole, I'm Steve Junker. Talk to you next week.